Hello, everyone. Welcome into South Beach Sessions. My name is Mike Ryan. I'm the executive producer of this podcast, along with some help from Anthony Calatayud and assorted assistance from the Shipping Container. As you know, this is beyond bizarre. This whole pandemic experience, this is a first for all of us. We're still trying to do our radio show, which you can still listen to 10 to 1. We're doing things with the simulcast that are just audio only on ESPN News. We're trying to give you a little slice of normal. Part of that is being married to the content machine. We're going to keep chugging along and putting these things out there for you, and we hope you really enjoy this interview, which we had stockpiled for opening day, but opening day has been pushed back, obviously, and we don't really know when baseball is going to be coming back. We don't really know when sports as we know it comes back. So let's get a little bit nostalgic with Tom Glavine. Tom Glavine, obviously, multi-time Cy Young winner. This guy was one of the great pitchers of his era on the Atlanta Braves, along with John Smoltz and Greg Maddux. He was a part of arguably the greatest starting pitching staff in the modern era. So Tom Glavine obviously has the bona fides to be interesting, but on top of that, he's a good talker, and he's got some great stories that Dan and he get into here in the South Beach session. If you listen to the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz, you know our show is obsessed with 1990s baseball. So this is a goldmine of nostalgia, and we hope you truly enjoy it. It comes brought to you by ZipRecruiter. When it comes to hiring for your business, ZipRecruiter can help you find the right candidates for your team fast. From healthcare to manufacturing to business services and more. And now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, our listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, now that my clumsy intro is out of the way, let's get to the real reason you're here listening to this podcast, to hear Tom Glavine talk to Dan Le Batard.
Tom, let's start here. Your son is a pitcher as well. How difficult has that been, and what are the benefits for him in having you as a father?
I don't know that it was that difficult, to be honest with you. I mean, to be truthful, I had to fight with him a little bit to get on the mound. He liked playing the outfield. He liked hitting. He pitched a little bit when he was 9, 10, 11 years old, but really enjoyed playing the field and batting more than anything else. And so I kind of had to prod him a little bit, and I would tell him all the time when I would play catch with him, I said, listen, you're left-handed. Ball comes out of your hand different. You need to pitch. And he's like, Dad, I don't really want to do that. And blah, blah. So anyway, he didn't. And it wasn't until he got to high school, and his junior year of high school, he started pitching and kind of fell in love with it. I think once he started to do it more and concentrated on it a little bit more, he had a different appreciation for it and really enjoyed it. So he loved it. And I think the benefit for him, obviously, is the conversations we can have. I can help him with mechanics. I can help him with the mental side of the game and thinking through what he's trying to do and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think there's a definite advantage there. At the end of the day, he's still got to go out and do it. But I think it certainly helps having somebody like me that's been through it and been through a lot of things that can kind of talk him through the struggles and the adjustments and all those things you try to make as a pitcher.
You're sort of famously stoic. What's it like for you watching him pitch?
I'm everything but stoic. it's hard when you're watching your kid. It's hard, and it's there's a different nervousness than I ever had when I was on the mound. I guess it would be similar to, people used to always ask me, were you nervous on the mound? And my answer is, yeah, I always was a little bit, of course.
Never looked it, though, Tom. Never looked it.
I should say maybe it was more leading up to it. Once I got on the mound, I was fine because now it's time to go and you just got to do your thing. But being on the mound, regardless of the situation, I was less nervous there than I would ever be when I was in the dugout watching somebody else pitch, because you're not in control. When you're on the mound, you're in control. And it's similar when I'm watching my son pitch. I don't have any control over what he's doing, but I'm living and dying with everything he's doing. So it's pretty nerve-wracking. I try to stay stoic and try to not show too much emotion when he's out there, but it's hard.
You came up through hockey, and didn't you choose baseball specifically because you controlled the whole game? You held it in your hand? Didn't you choose pitching for that reason?
That was part of it. I mean, I always loved hockey more so than baseball. And I think the reason was because when you play hockey, you know, you step on the ice, you're in the middle of the action. In baseball, that's not always the case. I mean, I loved playing center field. I loved playing first base. But, you know, there's periods of inactivity, so you can get a little bit bored. Being on the mound, that wasn't the case. When you're on the mound, it's similar to playing hockey. You're in the middle of the action every single pitch all the time. Everything kind of revolves around you. You're controlling the tempo of the game, all that stuff. And I don't think that aspect of it interested me. Hey, every pitch, every play I'm in the middle of, and this is fun. So I liked it from that standpoint. And I think that was part of the reason why I gravitated towards pitching, but I really was not all that different than my son, even up through high school. I loved playing the outfield. I loved hitting. I loved doing all that stuff. So, when I ultimately got drafted by the Braves as a pitcher, it was a little bit of a mental adjustment to think that, okay, I'm only going to pitch now. I'm not going to be able to hit and play the outfield anymore.
Do you have any other places in your life where you want control? Most human beings crave it, even if it's the illusion of control. Is your desire for control? Because Sabathia is pretty eloquent on the idea of nothing starts until I say so. There's a power in that.
I like to think I have that control, but I think my wife would probably have something to say about that. But I will say that my style of pitching was probably it very much mirrors my life. I'm very controlled in what I do. I'm very thought and process oriented. I like things organized. I don't necessarily like flying by the seat of my pants all the time. I like it once in a while because it's a change. But I'm more of a structured guy. I like to know what I'm doing, when I'm doing it, and that kind of stuff. But I would be lying to you if I said everything starts and ends with me. My wife has a lot more say in that than I care to admit sometimes.
How competitive were you with your son? Were you one of those dads who would play against him and not allow him to win?
You know, maybe at times. I mean, I had the fortune of being able to coach him. And both my boys, my younger boys, actually, when they were playing hockey and playing baseball and doing some of that stuff. So, you know, I think more so when I coached them in hockey, we would get competitive from time to time and, you know, maybe doing some drills on the ice where we were fighting one another for the puck and stuff like that. But aside from that, not a lot. I mean, I used to have fun with him when he was playing more and hitting more, and I would throw him batting practice. You know, every once in a while I'd slip in a changeup or I'd slip in a curveball and he'd swing and miss it, or hit it off the end of the bat and he'd look at me like, you know, what was that, and that kind of stuff. So, you know, from time to time I would, but I guess, yeah, I was probably one of those parents that I tried to be competitive with them just to get them to understand what competition was and how hard you had to work. Did I let them win from time to time, you know, just to keep them sane a little bit? Yeah, sure I did, but certainly not all the time. And if I let them win, it wasn't going to be without making them compete for it.
Is there anything about parenting that you apply specifically because you didn't have it and it was something that you craved? No indictment of your parents, just something that you wanted that perhaps you didn't have that you learned to apply to your own children.
I don't think so. Not really. You know, my parents were awesome in terms of their support, their involvement. I mean, my parents didn't miss a practice, let alone a game. So there was always somebody there. So I think 99% of what I am as a parent, I learned from how my parents parented me. I guess the only difference was I never, you know, my dad was a great athlete and played baseball, football, basketball, but He never coached me in baseball. And I always asked him why, and he always said, because I have to deal with the parents and I don't want to deal with the parents. So having had the ability to coach my kids, I understood after that what he meant. But I guess that's maybe the one thing. I mean, it might have been fun to have the opportunity to have my dad as a coach, but at the same time, you know, I know at times it was difficult for my kids having me as a coach, because let's face it, you're always harder on your own kids than you are on the other kids, just because you know they can take it. And I would be straight up with my kids and I would tell them, listen, I'm going to yell at you about something right now just because I'm trying to make a point to everybody else. So just take it and know I don't mean it personally on you. So, you know, you have those moments. Now, do your kids regret those or not like those moments? I don't know. I think by and large, my experience with my kids as their coach was pretty good. But it's different, definitely a different perspective.
You were in the All-Star game 10 times. You won the Cy Young twice. You won 300 games, one of only six lefties to do so. If I were able to give you the comparable career in hockey, would you choose it over the one you had in baseball?
Probably not. I think all the reasons I sat down at 18 years old and tried to make a list of the pros and cons of both sports, I think a number of them would still be in favor of baseball. Most notably, had I had the comparable career in hockey and played the amount of time that I would have needed to play in order to do the things that I would need to accomplish, I'm pretty sure my body would have taken a lot more of a beating than it did in baseball. You know, my shoulder hurt when I got done playing, and I had it fixed, and it hasn't bothered me since. Yeah, my knees are a little cranky from time to time, but I don't think it's anything compared to what my body would feel like if I had taken the beating that I know I would have taken on the hockey rink. So that would be a big factor. And, you know, I still am able to live the life that I currently live because I made good money in baseball. And in those years playing hockey, guys weren't getting paid that way. So I don't think there's any way I would have made the living in hockey that I made in baseball. So you know, I think the factors still would line up for me to choose baseball.
What's the item on your resume that you would point to? The baseball resume alone, among all of the achievements, what's the one that you would point to? That is the one that gives me the best feeling of personal satisfaction.
I think aside, obviously, from the wins, I think the number of starts and the innings pitched. You know, to me, that spoke to my longevity, my ability to take the ball every 5 days. And I think that's something that I took great pride in and I'm extremely proud of, you know. And it's not like, oh, I was lucky, I never was injured, I never had anything going on. I had things going on a lot. But, you know, I always felt like if I can take the ball, I'm going to take the ball. And if 80% of me is better than 100% of the guy I'm getting ready to face. So, there were a lot of times where looking back, maybe I should have spent some time on the DL or things of that nature, but I just felt like if there was any way I could take the ball every 5 days, I was going to do it. And like I said, I think the amount of starts and the amount of innings pitched, once it was all said and done, I think speaks to that longevity, and that's something I'm proud of.
Smoltz has told some great stories on our show about him and Barry Bonds shooting middle fingers at each other from the dugouts, going back and forth. And Smoltz told one story that involves you here and Barry Bonds misunderstanding possibly something that you and John Smoltz were talking about and getting his vengeance. I want to play that story for you from John Smoltz and get your reaction to it.
Well, there's a moment in the previous All-Star game that Barry had misheard what Glavin and I were talking about, thought that we were rooting for Mark McGuire on the other side, which we weren't. We were rooting for our guys and Barry. And so he just kind of went off the handle and said, next time I face you, I'm going to hit a home run off of you. And I might just do a little dance at the home plate. And I said, that's fine. Next time I face you, I might, you know, strike you out. And I might sit on the mound. Who knows? You know, touche. He goes, you know what? Matter of fact, I'm going to hit two off you next time I face you. He did.
I love
he hit
that.
Two.
I love that story so much.
He hit two. And he came to the bus after the game looking for me, taunting for, you know, and then realized that it was looking a little awkward. And he said, all right, guys, go get the ring because we had already sewed up our division. But he did. He hit two home runs off me and beat me.
Did he get on the bus?
He did.
He did.
He did. He got on the bus yelling, "Where's Smoke?"
And where were you? Were you hiding in the bathroom?
I was on the bus. I sat there and wore it. He did what he said he was going to do.
And what do you remember about that, Tom?
I remember that specifically where he hit the two home runs off him. And I can't quite remember if it stemmed from the conversation that we were having at the All-Star game, because it was the year that we got Freddie McGriff. And there was a conversation on the bus at the All-Star game, and Barry coming on, you know, basically like, "Hey, boys, it's too little, too late. You're not catching us." Because they had a pretty good lead on us at that point in time. So I think, you know, that may have been part of that conversation and part of what led to that talk about, you know, Barry hitting a couple home runs off him. But, you know, it was fun. Those two guys had that kind of relationship where they kind of went at one another and had some fun with each other, but, you know, obviously had a ton of respect for each other.
Did you think it was funny when Barry Bonds came onto the bus there, or did you think it was disrespectful?
No, I think it's, you know, certain guys can get away with that. And I think in Barry's case, he was one of those guys that could get away with it, because I think, you know, if you know Barry and you played against Barry, you know he's a tremendous competitor, but at the same time, he likes to have fun. And, you know, I think in his case, coming on the bus doing that, and certainly his stature in the game, he can get away with that. You don't look at it as disrespectful. I mean, he might for a second say, you know, "Hey, what the heck's this guy doing? What's going on here?" But and then you kind of just dismiss it and you go with it. Whereas, you know, somebody with a little less clout and a little different, you know, maybe outlook on him as an individual, probably couldn't get away with that.
So you're a lefty. If I say to you, who would you rather face? You got to pick one of these: Barry Bonds as a lefty or Gary Sheffield. I imagine that Gary Sheffield would be the one that you'd want to face less than that, but maybe I'm wrong. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, neither one of those guys really, if they're on their game. I mean, I was always, of all the guys that I faced, and you know, everybody always asks you, "Oh, who are you most afraid of?" I wasn't afraid of anybody. I mean, you respect guys, and obviously, guys at certain stages or during the season or whatever, if they're hot or they're cold, whatever, present different challenges. But I think the one guy I always said that scared me in terms of hitting a line drive back at me was Gary Sheffield. There was something different about how the ball came off his bat when he hit it, and it was a different sound to it. And I was always fearful that if he hit one back at me, I wasn't going to have time to get out of the way. So that was always something that was on my mind with him. Now, facing those two guys, who would I rather face? I'd probably rather face Gary, simply because, as everybody knows, lefty on lefty, my changeup wasn't as big a weapon for me as it was against righties. I mean, my changeup was my money pitch. So I felt like I had more options against righties than I did lefties, just because that changeup was neutralized a little bit more. So I probably would side with Gary, but, you know, certainly not as a disrespect to one guy's talent level over the other. It has everything to do with me and my repertoire.
What pitching staff throughout history do you look at and say that staff was better than our staff, or that, you know, the starting staff?
That's a good question. You know, obviously the one that we get compared to so often was the Orioles staff. And you know, those guys obviously were great, and I watched a lot of those guys when I was a kid. I'm sure there are others. I mean, you know, there have been discussions in today's game, and you know, the Mets staff always comes up. And I've heard Smoltz say at times that, you know, the Mets staff is more talented than we were, and I know he gets grief for that, but I know what he means. I mean, you know, you look around at today's game, and you take a staff like the Mets, and yeah, I mean, every one of those guys has better stuff than I did. Every one of them has better stuff than Greg did. Arguably, John had the kind of stuff that a lot of those guys have, but then it gets down to the pitching side of it. And, you know, stuff is one thing, but being able to go out there and utilize your stuff and actually, you know, translate that into wins is a different story. And you know, I think that's something that, you know, clearly that Mets staff has had trouble doing over the years. I mean, every year you look at the Mets and you look at those guys and you think, okay, you know, there's a team that's going to have to be reckoned with, and then somewhere along the line, guys get hurt, and it kind of falls apart. But it's hard, really, to look at too many staffs that have had the longevity and the success that we had. I mean, certainly you could look at Oakland, too, for a short period of time when they had Zito, Hudson, and Mulder. That was a pretty formidable threesome. But I guess where we separate ourselves from a lot of people or a lot of great staffs over the year was our ability to be able to do it for a long period of time together, which for a number of reasons just doesn't happen very often. We were fortunate that it did.
It's crazy that you had a guy on your own staff who was more accurate throwing a baseball than you were. It's nuts. When it comes to Greg Maddux, how would you explain to the layman in terms that we can understand how accurate he was?
It's hard to explain. I mean, if you delve into his numbers and you see his strikeout to walk ratio, you see, you know, a number of years in there where how few guys he walked. You look over the course of the career and how few guys he actually went to three balls on. I mean, it's really remarkable when you start to dive into his numbers. But I can just tell you, having been his teammate, I think the most remarkable thing about him during the time that I played with him was his consistency. I mean, he just, again, I speak from my own experience. You know, you go out there and you pitch enough games during the course of the year, you're going to have five or six stinkers where it just doesn't go your way. You give up some runs, you get taken out of the game early, and it's just not your night. I don't want to say I never saw Greg do that, but it was very seldom, particularly that run where he won his Cy Youngs in consecutive years. If he went out there and went seven innings and gave up two runs, it was a bad game. And it was just remarkable to watch how consistent he was in that regard, night in and night out. And then when you watch him pitch, I mean, it really was a lesson in artistry. I mean, he threw the ball where he wanted to. Each pitch set up the next pitch. You know, his misses were just really good misses where, you know, very seldom did he miss over the plate. You know, his misses were always out of the strike zone, where if he did miss, a hitter couldn't do much with it. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that if you were to turn on the TV and watch him, you would not be enamored by anything that he did, other than at the end of the game, you'd go, oh, my God, he just threw a two-hit shutout. and you know, that to me was just fun to watch.
When you say each pitch set up the next pitch, can you tell one of the mythological stories about him and his genius? I've heard many of them. You guys, when you were on with us together, Smoltz and Glavin and Maddux, you said that the story's not exactly true, that two pitches before a screaming foul ball was hit into your dugout. Greg Maddux said the way that this is setting up here, there's going to be a screaming foul ball into the dugout. What's a story that you could tell to sort of explain that he was a little bit ahead of even the greatest of the great?
Well, there's another story which I'm not privy to the conversation. I am privy to the results, so I think it's true. But I remember we were playing Montreal, and Vlad Guerrero was coming up. And it was a situation where he had an open base, and Bobby went out to talk to Greg about what he wanted to do. And I think Bobby kind of had his mind made up that, you know, he wanted to walk Vlad and move on to the next guy. And Greg had a conversation with him, and he said, Bobby, no, here's what I'm going to do, and he's going to pop up to third base. And I'll be damned if he didn't pop up to third base. So, you know, that's the kind of, you know, now some of those stories, I don't know how many of them are true, because, look, there are a lot of Greg stories out there, and there were a lot of times where we would goad Greg into saying something that was a little bit far-fetched, just to see if the media would run with it. And I'll be damned if a lot of times they didn't run with it. And then we would just kind of laugh about it after knowing that he just made something up. But that was the respect he had, rightly so, as a very smart tactician out there on the mound. And I'll be truthful with you. Early in my career, obviously you go through phases, but, you know, the first few years of my career were up and down. I was trying to find myself and do some things, and, you know, ultimately found my change up and got comfortable with that and took off in 1991. And really, I didn't think a whole lot about what I was doing those 91, 92, 93 before we got Greg. I just kind of went about my game plan, and I didn't really pay attention to what hitters were doing or how they were reacting to certain pitches. And, you know, it really wasn't until we got Greg and I started sitting down on the bench with him and watching games and talking about pitching and stuff like that, where you know, he was the first guy that I really talked to that talked about a hitter's reaction to your pitch and how that dictates, you know, what you can do on the next pitch or what he's looking for and things of that nature. So that's how he thought. You know, if he threw a pitch and he saw a reaction from a hitter, it went a long way towards dictating what his next pitch was. And to me, he was the best at doing that, and certainly hugely helpful for me in my career and starting to implement that in my game plan.
All of that said, though, he was also profoundly disgusting.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, people ask about, you know, tell me some Maddox stories, and it's like, I can't. You know, it's the kind of stuff you can't say in public, but he was fun to be around.
Well, he was feces obsessed. We can say some of it. Like, he just, you know, there
yes,
would be.
This is true. Yes, yes.
Okay. Thank you for confirming. That's the most controversial thing you've ever said. I know you're a good teammate and you avoided your controversies, but yes, you guys would happen upon all sorts of feces related pranks that were disgusting.
Yes. Yes. No question about it. I'll just leave it at that.
That's it. It's got to stay in the clubhouse. I already know. I've got some of it, but I'm not going to lead you there. You absolutely won't do it.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you one. I'll talk out of school one time. I remember spring training. We were about 2 days from coming back to Atlanta, and Greg went to the bathroom and used one of Walt Weiss's T-shirts to clean himself. And saw him do it, put Walt's T-shirt back in his locker. And about 3 days later, we're back in Atlanta, and we come back, and we go outside. We go to batting practice. We come back inside, and Walt's locker is next to mine in Atlanta. And he comes in, and he's kind of rummaging around his locker. He's got this look on his face, and I'm like, Walt, what's wrong? And I knew what was wrong. He said, something smells in my locker. There's something not right. And I'm like, oh, geez, I don't know what it could be, whatever. So he starts going T-shirt by T-shirt and finds the T-shirt that Greg had used. And, you know, without skipping a beat, it was Maddox. You know, so he was looking for Greg and was ready to kill him. So those are the kinds of things Greg liked to do.
It sounds like you were a bit of an enabler. It sounds like you were right there with your teammate.
It was like I wasn't going to talk out of school. I was being a good teammate. I didn't want to throw anybody under the bus.
Can it be told now after all these years how much you guys were upset as a professional franchise? You guys were all pillars of professionalism, even though Greg Maddox was shitting in everyone's locker. The John Rocker stuff that happened with you guys. Can you explain to me the level of angry you guys were at him?
Well, look, at you know, of course there's a huge level of anger because we were so much about, because of Bobby and the culture Bobby set, we were so much about going about our business. And you just show up at the ballpark, you do your job, you win the game, you go home, you come back, you do it again. You go on the road, you don't talk smack about anybody, you don't throw any bulletin board fodder out there, you just show up, you do your job, you go home. And it was a great formula, and it was a great routine. And now all of a sudden you have somebody that does something to where now you're spending an awful lot of time having to have conversations that have nothing to do with what you're doing on the field and what your team is doing. It's about all this periphery ancillary stuff. It's aggravating. You know, guys don't want to talk about other teammates and what other teammates are doing that has caused some sort of controversy. That's the last thing that guys want to do. So when you're spending time every city you go into having to answer questions about that Sports Illustrated article and what was said and did he mean it and what's he like, I mean, that's, you know, nobody wants to do that. So I mean, sure, it got frustrating and it got aggravating and guys were pissed off about it. And, you know, I remember it wasn't too long, might have even been the first weekend of the series, where we were in L.A., Rocker saved the game, and we came off the field and somebody threw something that hit Kevin Millwood in the head. And at that point in time, I said, I'm not going out on the field anymore when he saves the game. I'm not doing it. I'm not going to put myself in that position. So, you know, it was the kind of thing, like I say, that as an athlete and on a team that was relatively controversial free for so many years, with all the success we had, it was definitely, you know, a wrench in things that after a while just got tiresome to deal with, and we didn't want to deal with it.
What were the gambling stakes when you and Smoltz and Maddox would play golf?
Oh, they got out of hand sometimes. I mean, you know, a lot of times it would be me and Greg and a best ball against John. So, and it was always, we would start out with, you know, whatever the bet was, $20 a hole. And the rule was always, you know, if you get down two, it's an automatic press, or if you get pissed, you can press. And inevitably, if John lost the first hole, he would press. So we would have times where the bet got up pretty high, and probably stupid sometimes. But, you know, one of the funny ones, I remember we were playing, and, you know, we had, again, the two down automatic press, or you can press when you're pissed. And Greg and I were winning the match, and something happened on a hole. I don't know exactly what it was, but something happened and Greg got pissed. So we went to the next tee box, and Greg and I, like I said, were winning the bet, and he turns to John and he says, "We're pressing." And John said, "Greg, you can't press. You guys are winning." And Greg told John, he said, "You said we could press when we're pissed, and I'm pissed about what just happened, so I'm pressing the bet." So, you know, again, that was the kind of the banter that we would have going back and forth. So it was, you know, there were times, trust me, where I would get a little concerned because, you know, you might hit a ball a little bit off the fairway and it might be sitting on a root, or it might be sitting on something where you're thinking, man, I really don't want to have somebody break a wrist or whatever. But if you're losing your bet and Smoltz, your ball's on a root, too bad. You got to play it. So, you know, there were times where I thought, you know, this is getting a little bit out of hand, when I'm more concerned about trying to get my money back than I am about whether or not somebody's going to get hurt. But it was a ton of fun.
Five figures or six figures on the betting?
No six figure. I wouldn't do that. I worked too hard for what I had, so I wasn't going to give it away on the golf course.
Fair enough. So when you think of the most talented teammate you ever had, who do you look at? Just talent. I'm not talking about savvy or expertise or being great at what they do. I'm talking about just someone you looked at and said, the talent of this person is stupefying.
I think Smoltz would certainly be one of them, because there weren't many things that he couldn't do. Great pitcher, great golfer, great basketball player. But the only thing I saw him not be very good at was when we put goalie equipment on him one day in the locker room and I was taking shots at him. He wasn't very good at that. But there wasn't much that he couldn't do. I think of a guy like Andrew Jones. Tremendous athlete. To me, he's one of those guys that, and I struggle with it sometimes in today's game, because I think there are times in today's game where we have really good baseball players, but not necessarily good athletes, because we're in a world now where everybody plays one sport from 10 years old. So they don't have that diversity that we all had growing up. And I look at a guy like Andrew Jones, who could just run like the wind and made it look easy, made it look effortless, and, you know, just was fun, had a gracefulness about him, about how he played the game, and I know he was, you know, a good athlete with other things. So, you know, those two guys, I know Avery was a hell of an athlete. There wasn't much he couldn't do either.
But Tom, the ego on Smoltz to think that he could be a goaltender in hockey against you, who was like a very accomplished hockey player.
I know, but that was the beauty of Smoltz. Like I said, there isn't anything he doesn't think he can do, particularly if you challenge him to it. So, that's what made him fun. And I'll be honest, I think it's a big part of what made him successful as a pitcher, because he was not afraid of failure. If you challenge him to do something, he was going to do it. I mean, there aren't too many other guys that I know that can, you know, throw 90 plus with a slider and a forkball from hell, and then when his elbow hurts, decide he's going to throw knuckleballs and can actually do it and be successful at it.
Do you like baseball now?
I don't dislike it. I don't love the way the game is. Like I said, I think we... There are times where I watch the game and I get a little frustrated with it, from the standpoint of, you know, guys are bigger, faster, stronger, but I'm not convinced the game is played any better. I'm not a big fan of the three outcome at bat. I think a lot of the intricacies of the game have been lost in today's game with the strikeouts and the home runs. So, you know, do I not enjoy watching a good ball game? Sure, of course I do. Are there a lot of nights where I get tired of watching the style of game that's being played? Absolutely, I do. I get particularly frustrated with the amount of guys that go out on the mound that I perceive as throwers and not pitchers. You know, I love watching Jake DeGrom. I love watching, you know, a Verlander. I love watching guys that can go out there and actually... You know, yeah, those guys throw hard, but they actually can locate pitches and change speeds and do all those things. And I love watching those guys. I just, I really hate watching the guy who throws 95, is done in the fifth inning if he's lucky, won't throw a fastball when he's behind in the count. I just don't like that style that you see on an awful lot of nights.
Do you know some of the hockey players, the great hockey players that you were drafted ahead of? Do you know some of the names involved?
I will tell you that every chance I get that I run into Brett Hull, I remind him that I was drafted ahead of him. So that much I know. You know, I know there are a couple other ones. I mean, I've run into Luke Robitaille from time to time. Still shakes his head at the fact that I got drafted ahead of him. But, you know, that's kind of what I like to say is, you know, clearly I got drafted ahead of those two guys, and they were Hall of Famers, so I would have been a Hall of Famer in hockey, of course. But I don't really believe that.
What are you prouder of, two Cy Youngs or four Silver Sluggers?
Ooh, man. Well, I'll say this. The Silver Sluggers were fun because they gave me something to talk smack about with Greg and John. So that was good.
Oh, you got something else though. You got something else for a dynasty that ultimately ends up being just slightly disappointing because of how great you were. You were the World Series MVP on the one you won. Neither one of those guys were.
This is true, but I don't, it's way more fun throwing the Silver Sluggers in John's face. I can promise you that. than anything else. But look, I mean, the Cy Young Awards obviously are indicative of, what I did for a living, what my job was. And, you know, when you have, a great year and you get rewarded for it with a Cy Young Award, I mean, that, you know, obviously that's the ultimate, aside from winning a championship, which, you know, obviously is the pinnacle and you get to celebrate and do all that with your team. In terms of, you know, my job as a pitcher, the ultimate honor is, hey, you're a Cy Young Award winner. So, I mean, it's something that you're extremely proud of. But like I said, I talk more smack with John and Greg about my Silver Sluggers because I can't talk smack on Cy Young Award with Greg. He's got twice as many.
Well, what's the most prominent display in the trophy room? Like, where is the stuff that represents this?
I would say it's equal prominence between my MVP trophy and my two Cy Young Awards.
Can you explain to us what your best pitching performance was and what you remember about that pitching performance, what you believe was your greatest day or night on a mound?
Well, there were a couple, but they don't compare, obviously. I mean, I threw two shutouts in Denver, which is an achievement in and of itself. I couldn't tell you the details of that so much other than I know one of them I had to go through the Blake Street Bombers. Of Larry Walker and Galarraga and Bichette and Vinny Castilla. So to be able to do that against that lineup in Denver is something that I think is, you know, kind of pretty cool. But obviously the 95 World Series game, I mean, I can't sit here and tell you pitch by pitch, but I obviously remember a lot of the details about that game. And I remember being locked in that game and knowing after the first inning that not necessarily that I was going to go out there and throw a, you know, one hit shutout through eight innings, but I knew I was good that night. I knew I had my stuff, and it was just a matter of going out there and utilizing it over the course of the game, which fortunately I did. So, you know, given the circumstances and the magnitude of that game, obviously that would be the best game of my career.
Would you like a chance to, as someone who was never controversial throughout his career, to punctuate this podcast with a seismic news-breaking item of just tearing the Astros a new ass?
I can't. I'm not one of those guys. I will say that what they did was wrong. No question about it. I mean, there's a difference between a runner on second base getting a catcher's signs or, you know, somebody in the dugout seeing a pitcher tipping pitches and you utilize those things to your advantage. It's another thing to take it a step further and use electronics. And look, I'm not defending the Astros, but I think some of the comments I hear from guys I think are a little bit silly. I think the notion that, you know, everybody's piling on the Astros like they're the only ones that are doing it. Let me tell you something, they're not the only ones that are doing it. They got caught, but I can promise you there are other teams that are doing things. So I think there's a little bit of self-righteousness that's going on when you hear some guys criticize the Astros. But, again, I'm not defending what they did. What they did was wrong, and it shouldn't happen anymore. And I'm extremely disappointed in the Astros' reaction to it. You know, to me, I thought the only way they were going to get this thing over with was to get out in front of it and to answer questions and wear it and just say, yeah, we did it and we shouldn't have done it. But when I hear comments from guys saying, yeah, we did it, but we really don't think it had an effect on the game or the outcome of the game, it's like, come on, you can't say anything more stupid than that. You know, that's like the argument in my day where, you know, people trying to justify guys doing steroids and saying, well, they still have to hit the ball. Well, if you didn't think that those things were helping you, you wouldn't be doing it. So to say that what you were doing didn't have an effect on the outcome of the game, well, of course it did. That's why you kept doing it. So, you know, I've been disappointed in that part of it, but I think the calls to strip them of their championship are a little bit silly. I think some of the other comments I hear are a little bit silly. But, again, having said that, in no way, shape do I condone what they did. I think what they did is disgusting and it's wrong. And they need to do a better job of taking responsibility for it.
What does Tom Glavin remember about being booed?
Well, it depends on where it was.
I'm talking about during negotiations. I'm talking about how often you were getting booed because you were fighting for stuff in your role as someone who was an important member of the MLB Players Association.
I mean, it wasn't easy. And I will say this, looking back on it, it was an unbelievable learning experience to be a part of all that and be in on negotiations, you know, ultimately go to the White House and talk to President Clinton and try to figure out a way through that thing and really just seeing how it all unfolded. It was an unbelievable learning experience. I will admit, no question about it, I was naive. And I think my biggest mistake in that whole process was being naive to think that I would do every and any interview that was requested of me, because if I just had somebody's attention for 5 minutes, I could change their mind if they didn't agree with us. And looking back at it, that wasn't the case. I think that was very much a situation where people kind of had their minds made up. They were either on our side or they weren't. And there were very few people that were in the middle. So for the people who were not on our side, I became associated with the problem. You know, it almost became, you know, that I was the cause of the strike, like it was my idea. People could be in a restaurant somewhere that had a TV and saw my face on there and didn't have any idea what I was saying, but just looked at it and hated me because I was the face of what was going on and I was the face of what they perceived to be as the greed of the players. So, you know, there just wasn't any way to make people who didn't side with us understand what the issues were, what we were fighting for, why we were fighting for it. So I was naive in that regard. But look, I think anybody who knows me knows that there was no other way I was going to do that job. I was going to do it to the best of my ability. I was going to keep my teammates as informed as I possibly could. And in order to do that, I had to be involved. And I wouldn't change any of that. But it wasn't the greatest of receptions when we came back or I came back and pitched games for the early part of the season. But like I said, it's just you can't be fearful of doing something that you think is right because you're afraid of what the repercussions are going to be. If you think it's right, then you don't worry about what the repercussions are.
Tom, always appreciate your time and appreciate your general way of being. Thank you for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Happy to do it.
Thank you, sir.
Truly enjoyed having Tom Glavin on South Beach Sessions. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review. We here at Levitard and Friends are going to do our best in trying to deliver you content as you're used to getting it, even though the circumstances here are a bit surreal. Also, check out The Right Time with Bomani Jones. Bomani's a great friend of ours, and he has a tremendous podcast. So make sure you go ahead and do that. Mystery Crate and The Local Hour and The Dan Levitard Show with Stu Gatz. Some of our properties might have delayed releases. Some of them might not have releases at all for the time being as we try to work with what we're given. But we thank you so much for your support, and we promise you we're going to do our very best to deliver you the content you so rightfully deserve.